Welcome to the podcast, Daddy.
A special introduction from Alexandra Shaw, my two-year-old. Welcome back. Apologies for no episode last week. My wife Lauren and I were at sea aboard Ice Bear, Andy Schell, and Mia Carlson's 59-foot Hermann Frères design Swan. We were sailing on a passage with them from Annapolis to Lunenburg. We had a great time. Good crew, good captain and mate, an amazing boat, great passage, 805 miles. While aboard, I recorded an interview with Andy and Mia. That's not today. I'm going to save that for a future episode. Today, I'm talking with Randall Reeves, who, as luck would have it, landed in Nova Scotia on his boat, Molly, just a few days before we arrived in Nova Scotia on Ice Bear. So I caught up with him. If you've listened to episode 2 of this podcast, you know about Randall and his audacious figure eight voyage. If you haven't heard it, I encourage you to go back and listen. It was recorded while he was sailing in the Southern Ocean, and we talked via sat phone. As a quick recap, Randall's attempting to be the first person to circumnavigate both Antarctica and the Americas. And he's calling this the figure eight voyage. He left last September from San Francisco, and he's been sailing alone for 227 days. He sailed down the Pacific, around Cape Horn twice, and then up the Atlantic and made landfall just a couple weeks ago in Halifax. From the start, Randall intended to stop and wait for the Northwest Passage to open up before he headed through, but his plan originally was to stop in St. John's, Newfoundland, which is more along his intended route. But he hit some weather in the Atlantic, and that led to a busted wind vane and a ripped sail, so he made land a few hundred miles south in Halifax. His boat Molly is currently anchored off the Armdale Yacht Club, just across the northwest arm from Halifax. Lauren and I picked Randall up from the dinghy dock there, took him out for a dinner and a few beers, and then came back to the marina where we found the quietest spot we could in the clubhouse to record this short interview before we got kicked out as the club was closing. A quick shout out also to the Ocean Cruising Club port captain in Halifax, John Venice, who was kind enough to shuttle Lauren and me from Lunenburg to Halifax so we could catch up with Randall and then catch our flight home to San Francisco. So no more blabbering from me. Here's the interview with Randall Reeves shortly after making landfall after 8 months at sea. First, welcome back to land. And
lovely to be here.
Describe the landfall and the experience of coming in to Halifax.
It was foggy, and I couldn't believe it. I don't think I saw land until I almost hit the lighthouse, and that's not much of a landfall, actually. I was very disappointed. I wanted to see high mountains and big bays. No, I saw fog for like 3 days. But it was lovely. The landfall was incredible because once we got in close, I could actually see the trees. And I've done several passages of some length, but I've never done a passage of 237 days, a full 8 months away from land. Saw Cape Horn. I think I may have seen one or two of the Southern Islands. But for the most part, I didn't see any land at all for a solid 8 months. And I didn't realize how much I missed seeing trees until I saw them again. And along the coast here, it's a fairly low coast as you approach, fairly rocky, and there's a big white lighthouse. And then as the fog lifts, you actually see this great forest of evergreens mixed in with deciduous trees. It was just great. That was the big epiphany. It was like, whoa, trees. Wow, how great is that? Trees. I think I did that in the video that I made as I was coming in, because it just really blew me away. That was lovely. And then just one of the things that actually was kind of strange about coming to land after 8 months was how strange it wasn't. You'd kind of think that, you know, a guy who's been at sea for 8 months would have a near religious experience just seeing another human face and like jumping off the dock and having his first beer and all that kind of stuff. And all that was wonderful. But it wasn't as profound as I kind of thought it might be. And I think that was simply because I've done a fair bit of this in, over the last year in particular, but also over the last 2 or 3 years, going away, coming back, going away, coming back. So the going away, coming back paradigm is kind of ingrained at this point. But it's been really nice to be on land. I have had, in the last 12 days, 11 hot showers, and I have done 4, 5, maybe 6 loads of laundry. And that's been pretty cool, I have to say.
You had some rough weather in the Atlantic coming up. Tell us about the last leg and why you're here in Halifax and not in St. John, where you were initially intended to go.
For a long time, the target has been St. John's. St. John's is on the route and gives me a really great launch point for the Arctic. But, yeah, I got bit pretty hard in the North Atlantic. I had been really wrestling with either light winds or contrary winds, winds from the north, for ever since I got above the horse latitudes in the North Atlantic. And I forget the date now, but I saw this beautiful low-pressure system coming off the northeast. Beautiful meaning strong winds, one of those perfectly round lows. Mostly what I saw in that was strong winds from the southwest for a couple of days. I was just desperate for northing. By the time I got back to Cape Horn for the second time, my average per day was 145 miles. By the time I got to that low, my average per day for the Atlantic run was 110. Just awful. I was personally crushed by the lack of speed in the Atlantic. So I made what I think was a sound decision given the data that I had, but I had not paid attention to the data that I could have had. I grabbed the southwesterly winds in this low and I rode north, northeast for I think 2 days. Great northing. I was doing like 160 miles a day. And then I threw out the drogue on the evening of that second day as the wind started to clock around to the west and then north, northwest, with the idea of kind of just sitting there on the drogue and holding on to the northing that I'd gotten. And what I didn't anticipate well enough was that I had dived up into the lower part of the Gulf Stream, and I had southwesterly current, which was being pushed against pretty hard by the northwesterly winds coming down. The seas were a lot larger than I had anticipated given the wind. Wind was 35-40, so it's a good chunk of wind, but that's sailable wind for my boat. Should be able to handle that pretty well. But on the drogue, we were getting pushed around pretty hard, really steep seas. And on the second day, I was below at the time, trying to read. Sitting on a Jordan Series drogue is very safe for the boat, very uncomfortable for the passengers. And the motion on the boat is just awful.
How's it different than just rough seas?
That's a great question.
I'm just curious.
I think what's different about it is that the boat is not just riding in the sea, it's being pulled backwards, or it feels like that, right? The drogue is super powerful. The Jordan Series drogue is a tiny parachute about every foot for about 300 feet of length of line, and it will pull the boat through the backside of a sea. It is that powerful. So instead of riding with the sea, which is what you're used to on a sailboat, you're riding and being pulled back, and riding being pulled back, and this is fine for the boat. I mean, as I described in the blog at one point, I was up on deck, and the boat looked great. She was having a great time, right? She was riding comfortably. Below was just awful. The boat motion was extreme. So it was really hard to cook. It was really hard to read. Really kind of napping was all that was comfortable. So anyway, I'm below. And we had taken a few seas into the cockpit over the house. But we got hit really hard. It just felt like being rear-ended by a Mack truck. Wham! And there was a kind of a crashing sound. And I run up on deck. I didn't have fallies on at that point, so I had to get fallies on. Run up on deck, and I see that the drogue has actually grabbed Monty, the wind vane, the paddle, which was in the upright position, broke the lashings that was holding it in the upright position, pulled it down, and then wrapped around the pendulum and has bent the pendulum to starboard and also bent the frame to starboard. So what happened was the bridle had been slack. The sea, which was especially large, brought the bridle with it. The bridle wrapped around the drogue, and then the weight of the boat came on the drogue and pulled it to, in this particular case, pulled it to starboard and just essentially wrecked the wind vane. That was a pretty severe incident. So that was the weather you're referencing. That was our one big gale in the Atlantic. Other than that, the ride was pretty good. Slow, but pretty good. Yeah, that was quite an experience.
You rely pretty heavily on Monty, your wind vane. What goes through your mind when you come up on deck and see that?
Nothing I can talk about online. Well, the first thing that goes through your mind is I have to get the bridle unwound from Monty, from the pendulum, and then I have to get that pendulum arm off the drogue before it winds up again. So the frame of the wind vane was bent, but at that point I thought it was, and it probably was actually salvageable. I could probably have sailed the wind vane in. But there was an extreme chance that it would wrap again if I didn't get the pendulum off. And that's a procedure. It took 2 or 3 hours to get that undone, partly because of the seas. Seas were big. And, you know, here I am. I'm on my hands and knees down on the gunwales trying to get a stainless steel pin about 6 inches long and 1 inch wide to come out. It holds the pinion gears together and about 100 pieces of little plastic bearings. Trying to get that all apart without losing everything and without being dragged overboard. You work for a few seconds, and then you have to jump up into the radar arch as the seas come over the boat and come under you, and that's just, it was crazy. And then, of course, I wasn't thinking straight, so I drew the pin toward the boat as opposed to pushing it out from the boat. It got jammed in toward the boat. I actually had to cut a hole in the gunwale to keep pulling it all the way in. And so, you know, all of this is happening. It's getting dark. The wind is still blowing. The bridle of the drogue could wrap at any time. You're under a lot of stress to get that done. So I wasn't really thinking about my good friend Monty and how I'd survive without him. I was just trying to save the situation at that point. As it turns out, I have autopilot, which performed very well for the next 5 or 6 days. That's what really got me into Halifax.
The figure eight voyage that you're undertaking, it really has two parts. And you have successfully completed the first part. You've gone around Cape Horn twice. Now you are looking at the Northwest Passage. What are you thinking about? What considerations are going through your mind as you look forward to the second half of this challenge?
One of the things that I find interesting about the figure eight is that the two parts of the figure eight are about as different from each other as one can imagine. So I've just completed the 8-month blue water voyage part, where it's all open water and water's like 15,000 feet deep and you don't see land for months on end. Big, beautiful waves. And I'm about to dive into a section of the figure eight voyage that is just the opposite. So the Arctic is all about shallow waters, not well charted, islands and rocks everywhere, cold weather, unpredictable weather, and ice pack. So it's a very different animal. If you look at a chart of the area right above Canada in particular, you'll see that it's dotted with all kinds of islands and very small passages. And one of the things that makes it challenging is that it really is like, especially given the ice overlayer, it's really like threading through a maze. Certain parts of the Arctic will open. They won't always open synchronously. And you may have a gate in front of you open now, but the gate ahead of you isn't open yet. You may get to that gate and it's not open yet, and the gate in back of you may close. So one of the biggest challenges actually of the Northwest Passage is just the stress of managing the emotions of getting through it. Will I make it? Or will I have to leave the boat at a particular juncture? Will I get trapped in the ice and stuff like that? So there's a lot of that kind of, and two, it's from my experience, there's a lot of motoring. You're relying more on the mechanical systems of the boat than I ever did. So the autopilot and the engine and those systems have to be in top shape. So it's just a different exercise altogether.
What did you personally find more challenging in the past 8 months, the physical or the mental challenges?
One of the stories for me as a sailor that was so informative was that 1968 Golden Globe race. Right, you've got Matissia and Knox Johnson and Crowhurst, the triad. And how did those guys handle the mental and physical challenges? And I always come back to Crowhurst, who kind of was in over his head. And I don't experience the sea in that way, usually. But I must admit, it was 8 months is a long time. And even though I do have communications with shore pretty much every day, there were still times when it's like, wow, you know, where's home? Which way's up some days? So not seriously and not deeply, but I got to have just the slightest inkling into what Donald Crowhurst experienced when he left on the 1968 Golden Globe race and didn't come back. I would say the question is a good one, and I don't have a clear answer for it. The physical challenges are constant, especially in the Southern Ocean, where it's rough and cold most of the time. One of the biggest challenges in the South is just how dynamic the system is. Weather changes every 6 to 10 hours. We're used to tropical sailing, right? Where you set the sails, it could be a week before you have to do anything. It's like beautiful. In the South, it's 6 to 10 hours and you're up doing a major sail change. The lows, there's just no land to interrupt the flow of the low pressure systems, and they just roll through and roll through and roll through. And even when you're doing well, because the goal is to be positioned on that top third of the low pressure system, even when you're doing well, it's still tricky, and you don't always know when you've got a big one coming through, you know, did I pick the right latitude? Is it really going to be what the grip file says it's going to be? It's really a combination of both. I found for myself that although it's not really that cold in the South, it's cold. It's 40, 45 degrees, always. You get used to being warm in your sleeping bag when you're sleeping, and anytime you're up, you're just cold. Your hands are always cold, your feet are always cold. Anytime you're up and around, you're always cold. Often wet, the boat is not heated. So after a few months, damp, everything's damp. You know, it's just because I'm below so much of the time, the entire inside of the boat is damp and mildew's growing on the ceiling and stuff like that. So that begins to add up after a while. And then my particular challenge in this rounding was that I noticed that I had barnacles on the bottom about halfway around the Southern Ocean, and it began to take its toll where speed is concerned, and that was very upsetting. I'm not sure in hindsight I made the right choice, which was to not do anything about them, because I'd had experience with barnacles before, and getting them off with a pressure washer in Hobart last year took all afternoon. Me on a snorkel and a wetsuit under the boat with a spatula didn't seem like it was going to do that much, so I decided to ride that out. In hindsight, I'm not sure that was the right decision, because we had a better time getting them off here in Halifax than I had anticipated. But that really, the fact I had a particular speed goal in mind going around the South, and that did not come to fruition. I didn't make that goal. And that was I find that really upsetting. But to be down there, even when it's bad, even when the low pressure system is coming through and it's, you know, it's 50 to 60 and the seas are huge, you have the sense of being able to see something that so few people get the opportunity. And granted, few people want to see it, but I wanted to see it and to have the opportunity to see the ocean in the raw like that, to be in seas where you think to yourself, I'm not sure if we can do this, I'm not sure how I'm going to get the boat out the other end of this low, and then have an albatross or a prion just come like drifting on by, and this is my backyard and I'm just doing fine. It's just wild. I mean, this is where they live. They're adapted to this wild, crazy, rough, extreme environment. It's just great to be able to see that.
Does that make you feel like a fish out of water, or hopeful that if they can survive, you can survive?
It depends on the low, actually. Oftentimes, it can be fish out of water. I've gotten the boat into a dangerous situation, and she's struggling. But the feeling of privilege, you know, being able to see that, to see them. These animals have probably never seen a human before, and I got to see them. That's really cool.
Talk about sleep deprivation. I know Matt Rutherford talks about slowing his body down to go half speed to match the slowness of his mind. How did that factor into the trip?
My sleep strategy definitely changed on this trip. This is the longest trip I've done by far. And my habit has been to sleep in 60-minute cycles. My deal with myself is I can sleep as many 60-minute cycles as I like, but never for more than 60 minutes. I found after about 2-3 months of that, I was getting weak-kneed and feeling kind of loose in the head. So I changed that up to 90-minute intervals and was pretty good at keeping that. If the boat was going well, if I knew there wasn't anything in the near term, there were times when I would just shut off the alarm and sleep. But even then, I rarely slept for more than 2 hours. That's an interesting comment you make, though. I don't think I've ever thought of it in terms of consciously slowing down, but you do. In fact, there are times when you know the weather's changing and you know that for the next couple of hours you're going to be going northwest and you really want to go west. And you could go west if you put on foul weather gear and went up on deck and did something about it. But you're not going to, you know, because you need a little bit of rest. You need to be able to stay rested and sane. So let the boat go in the wrong direction for a couple hours, get some good sleep, and then go up and make sail change. And I got to actually, if the weather was light to moderate, I would make sail changes oftentimes at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, as opposed to necessarily right as things began to shift. I'm not racing, by the way, right? I'm not trying to make huge numbers of miles. I'm trying to survive. And part of the survival mechanism is not getting yourself completely worn out by trying to make the boat go real fast and changing sails all the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. What have you learned from the first half of the Figure Eight voyage that you're going to take and put into practice for the second part?
Well, I think that the fact that there was a second try at the Figure Eight voyage suggests that I made some mistakes on the first one. And I went into the first Figure Eight with the intention of sailing through the lows, deploying a storm drogue as rarely as possible. I was going to sail through everything, the Bernard Potessier, Vito Dumas strategy. And I did that. I think it was the right call, but I don't think I deployed enough sail. That may seem strange to say, but we got knocked down a great number of times, actually, between the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. And almost always those knockdowns happened in the last third of the low. So the last third of the low, the wind is starting to tail off. You've gone through the first and second. You're in the third stage. So you've experienced the northwesterlies. You've got west, and now the wind is southwest, but it's tailing off. So you have large, confused seas. And I think the mistake I made was to not deploy more sail. So I had a storm jib up oftentimes in that part of the low, but would slow down. Seas are huge. When the wind begins to slack up, the seas will actually jump up. And we didn't have a whole lot of wind in the trough of those seas, and that's almost always when we got into trouble. So the biggest strategy change I made from Figure 8 1 to Figure 8 2 was to actually didn't use the storm jib at all. The whole time in the Southern, 110 days in the Southern Ocean, and it was all on the number 2. I would roll it up to until I felt good. Wasn't in great shape, but I would, you know, use that as the storm jib. And that allowed me to, as the wind started to taper off, to quickly unroll and keep boat speed up. And I think that was the major change, and no knockdowns at all.
Looks like the yacht club here is closing up on us, but I want to get one last question in here for you. Tell us about when you're taking off for the next stage, what you're looking for in terms of ice clearing up.
The Arctic typically doesn't open or begin to open until August or the first week of August. So my intention is to depart Halifax the latter part of June. I'll cruise up the Greenland coast for most of the month of July with the goal of being in Upernavik which is about halfway up the Greenland coast, roughly the end of July. I'd like to be able to cross over into the Arctic first week of August. Don't know what the Arctic will look like then. From what I've heard, the wire seems to suggest that the melt is more aggressive this year than in the last couple of years, which is good, because the last couple of years have been very difficult for yachts trying to get through the Northwest Passage. I believe only one made it through last year. But what I'm hearing so far, and it's still very early in the year, but what I'm hearing is that the Arctic is opening a little more quickly than the last couple of years, so I've got some good news there. But I'd like to be in Lancaster Sound, which is the entrance on the eastern side, first week of August, just to be ready for whatever happens next.
Thank you, Randall. I really appreciate you taking the time. It was great that we just happened to be in the same city here in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and run into you. And I want to wish you all the best on the next leg and look forward to greeting you as you sail back under the Golden Gate.
Well, thank you, Ben. It was excellent to see you and Lauren this evening. It was a lot of fun. Nice to chat with friends from the Bay Area, and best of luck to you too.
Randall was talking about using a Jordan Series drogue, and there's more about that, more technical information about his use of drogues in a really interesting video conversation that John Harries, the editor of the Attainable Adventure website, recorded with Randall. They talk about different options for deploying and retrieving drogues. So I encourage you to go to Attainable Adventure or Randall's site, figure8voyage.com. That's figure, the number 8, voyage.com, and watch the video there if you're interested. On that same site, you can find Randall's latest writings. He's a really great writer, and he's been blogging about the trip and sending some video all the way along. And Latitude 38's Electronic Latitudes also posts regular updates on Randall's trips, so you can follow him there as well. If you enjoy the podcast, take a minute or two to review it on iTunes and tell your friends about it. You can find me, Ben Shaw, at outthegatesailing@gmail.com or on Instagram as outthegatesailing. Thanks for listening.